Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, in Nova Scotia, a Brooklyn family business is getting ready to take on all of Canada with its adaptable backpacks. Ed Halverson has that story. A bird expert warns about biodiversity loss, clearly one of the major issues of our time, but solutions do exist.
You know, we've kind of known anecdotally for years just by looking at the breeding bird survey trends that many species were in decline. And then since 2019 now, we have actually an estimate of how many fewer birds there are now than there were 50 years ago, and that's approximately 3 billion, which is a massive amount.
In Quebec, a Prince Edward County Hospital fundraiser exceeds expectations, $20 million raised. The Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Center in Halifax gets a $4 million helping hand from the federal government.
This is the first big tranche of federal funding that's been made available to support the construction of the project. So it's to help pay for the design and some portion of the construction of a new Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Center in downtown Halifax.
And in Pontiac, Quebec, the George Bryson Heritage House reopens, work is completed, and exhibits in place.
Beautiful house. I think when I opened the door, it was already here. But you just pass and you don't wonder, it's here and it's built up, and you just come in and you fall in love with it somehow.
Welcome to Viewpoints. The Parley Manufacturing Company, a Brooklyn-based business, is hoping to conquer Canada and beyond with a new product line and a fresh approach to their business. The business got advice from Nova Scotia Business, Inc. and Digital Nova Scotia. The company refreshed its website and will soon be selling new products directly to customers online. The Parley Manufacturing Company launched their versatile integrated packs that can be tailored to any situation. The goal is soon to have Parley products in the hands of first responders across Canada. More with Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Parley Manufacturing launched their versatile integrated packs as a customizable off-the-shelf solution that can be tailored for any situation. Glenn Parley, president of Parley Manufacturing, says the product was born from the close relationships with first responder agencies across Nova Scotia.
Actually seeing how the product is used and talking to the people on the front lines, not a purchasing agent, but a person on the front lines that's using it, and asking the question, what would make your job easier? What would work better for your particular application? That's the information that we need to make a product that's always up to date and ready to go.
Members from EHS LifeFlight and the Department of Natural Resources and Renewables were on hand at the product launch to demonstrate how the modular system has been adapted to their particular uses. Even before the pandemic hit in 2020, Parley Manufacturing was looking for ways to better connect with their customers. With the help of Nova Scotia Business Inc. and Digital Nova Scotia, the company has rebranded and refreshed their websites and will be selling the new products direct to customers online. Parley says by cutting out the middleman, they can not only reduce costs and stay competitive against offshore producers, but give the customer what they want.
Maybe the setup that they see online, one of our sample ones that maybe a local organization is using, doesn't sort of fit with their needs. We can help them decide, okay, if we change some of these with these accessories, this might work for you. And then we can, again, customize a pack without making a custom pack.
Parley and his wife Kathy started selling adventure products in 1985 and rebranded the business to Parley Manufacturing in 2003. With a full-time workforce of 9 people, they still produce everything in their shop in Brooklyn just outside Liverpool. Parley says when dealing with a larger order, the family business can bring in up to 15 people. Despite problems in other sectors, he doesn't see his company having an issue finding labor.
Our average employee is not sort of the average employee. Most of our seamstresses are folks that maybe are beyond, their kids are gone back to school, or they may be folks that have their kids in school, so we're very flexible.
Parley says their products are already in use across Nova Scotia, and with the new product line, new business model, and new online presence, the goal is to have Parley products in the hands of first responders across Canada in short order. I'm Ed Halverson.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
So we stay on the East Coast, where research based on bird point count data gathered in the Maritimes Breeding Bird Atlas and published by Bird Studies Canada shows that forestry practices in the Maritimes have degraded the habitat of forest birds, causing their populations to rapidly decline. The research relies on large numbers of volunteer bird watchers that contribute their time and skills to gathering the data. To talk about this decline, our journalist David Gordon-Kosh spoke with wildlife biologist Craig Campbell from the Canadian Wildlife Services, a bird expert who participated in gathering that data.
There are some species of birds where we know that almost the majority of them are declining, and those are things like aerial insectivores like swallows and shorebirds like you'd see at Johnson's Mills. For forest birds, it's a little bit of a more muddled picture because you have some species which do seem to be increasing and others which are declining. It does seem that most of the species that are declining tend to rely on old forest habitats, which corresponds with what this study found.
So what are some of the examples of bird species that we've seen on the decline in terms of forest birds that rely on these old forests that you were speaking about a moment ago?
Some of the ones we get are often the warbler species. Some of them like younger forests, but some of them like the Blackburnian warbler, which is pointed out in the paper, that do tend to prefer mixed forests that are kind of older and more complex in structure. They have been declining rapidly over the last 20 or 30 years, according to the Breeding Bird Survey data. So seeing something like this in another publication, which takes a different data source, also seems to confirm that and reinforce it.
What about bird species that you've seen that have actually increased? What are some examples, or what kind of habitats do they rely on?
One species that we've been seeing increasing a lot is the palm warbler, which originally the kind of their traditional habitat is sort of swamps and bogs, but they do seem to now like areas that are regenerating forest, so that kind of mimics the young stunted growth that you get in a bog. So those species have been increasing according to the Breeding Bird Atlases and other data sources. So it's not that surprising to me that we'd be seeing increases according to the methodology in the paper as well.
Just wondering if you could talk about your background a little bit in terms of research and also your experience in the Tanchmar area, which of course is known for its bird populations.
The last 5 years I've been working in Newfoundland as a boreal bird ecologist mostly, so I was part of a group that designed a monitoring program to monitor bird health across the boreal forests of Canada, and I'm mostly responsible for the Newfoundland and Labrador part of that. Previously, I lived in Sackville for about a dozen years, and I worked for an organization called Birds Canada, which at that time was working in the office with the Canadian Wildlife Service and is now in downtown Sackville. And at that point, I was working on many different things. I was running a coordinated project for owl surveys, so running these 18-kilometer routes all across New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and PEI, and monitoring owl health, health of owl populations. I also participated a lot in the Maritimes Breeding Bird Atlas, which ran from 2006 to about 2010, and other projects as well, essentially all related to birds.
And so the data sources that are used in the study include things that you worked on directly in terms of...
Yeah, directly, yeah. Uh-huh. Both the data from the Breeding Bird Atlas, some of those data would have been ones I would have contributed to it, and also for the Breeding Bird Survey data that was used to compare with the paper's results. Some of those data would have also been ones that I'd gathered as well. There was a paper that came out, I believe it was in 2019, that showed that there were 3 billion fewer breeding birds in North America than there had been 50 years previously. And many of those birds were from forested habitats, and it kind of outlined deforestation as being a major cause, habitat degradation, and there were other factors as well. It's always been very difficult to measure habitat degradation, which is what's interesting about this paper. Was there a way of attempting to do that? But yes, it's been well established we've kind of known anecdotally for years just by looking at the Breeding Bird Survey trends that many species were in decline. And then since 2019 now, we have actually an estimate of how many fewer birds there are now than there were 50 years ago, and that's approximately $3 billion, which is a massive amount. It did generate a lot of news when that paper came out.
How serious do you think that this kind of loss of biodiversity is?
Well, it's clearly one of the major issues of our time, along with climate change, and they're not, you know, those two things are related to some degree. There is a lot of kind of doom and gloom type of news, but there's also some good news as well. So in 2019, there was the State of Canada's Birds was published, and it showed trends for all different bird species groups over the last 50 years. And some species were really declining, like the swallows and grassland birds like bobolink and shorebirds. But other species, and forest birds fell about in the middle of that, but other species like waterfowl and birds of prey, their populations had more than doubled over that same period of time. And that was entirely due to, you know, changes in the way we manage things. Populations were very, very low in the early 20th century because the waterfowl had been essentially hunted, in many cases, almost to extinction. Also, wetland conversion was a problem. And pesticide use was a problem for raptors. You know, DDT was causing, basically removing the calcium and causing the birds of prey to crush their eggs when they sat on them to nest. But through, you know, banning the use of pesticides and then at more active management, hunting management, and recreation and restoration of wetlands, those populations actually doubled over the course of time. So we can do stuff to help this. It doesn't need to continue necessarily on this trajectory. Some of the issues we're facing now are larger scale than, you know, the overhunting or the use of pesticides, which was an easy one because we knew there was basically one cause for, you know, the declines to birds of prey, or one major cause. In our cases now, it's sometimes a little bit more complicated, but it is proof that something can be done about it and, you know, not necessarily have to wait hundreds of years to see the result. It can happen fast.
That was David Gordon Kosh. We now go to Ontario, where the Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital Foundation has raised $20.7 million in donation for its new hospital, surpassing by 125% its original community goal. The Ontario government recently approved designs for the projected hospital, along with its prior commitment to cover 90% of the construction costs. Local dignitaries, including Prince Edward County Mayor Steve Ferguson, Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte Chief Ronald Maracle, and Member of Provincial Parliament Todd Smith, attended the foundation's Back to Build event. The Rick and Debbie Daynard family donated $1.5 million to the $20 million effort. The foundation is now looking for an additional $6 million to cover additional construction and equipment costs. They hope this will be achieved by 2027, the year the new hospital is expected to be in operation. More with Alexander Wright in Picton, Ontario.
Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital Foundation announced that it had raised $20.7 million in donations for its new hospital, 125% of its original community goal. This past April, the provincial government approved preliminary designs for the hospital along with its prior commitment to covering 90% of the construction costs. The community portion of the fundraising covered the remaining 10% of construction costs, as well as costs for the purchasing of new equipment. Local dignitaries, including Prince Edward County Mayor Steve Ferguson, Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte Chief R. Donald Maracle, and MPP Todd Smith, attended the foundation's Back to Build event, where they made the exceptional fundraising announcement. As well, Rick and Debbie Daynard were present to officially contribute their major donation of $1.25 million to the community effort. Now the foundation's goal is to raise $6 million more to cover additional construction and equipment costs. The hope is that this will be achieved by 2027, the year the new hospital is expected to be in operation. The next generation hospital is now projected to be 95,000 square feet in size, sporting smart technology, a CT scanner, and will have a net zero carbon footprint, a potential first in North America.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
We go back east, where the Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Centers in Halifax, Nova Scotia also got good news. The center is receiving $4.91 million in investment from the Government of Canada to build new facilities and programs. The center will be moving to a more urban location to better serve its clientele. The announcement was made on May 19th by Andy Fillmore, Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry, and Member of Parliament of Halifax. Fillmore spoke on behalf of other government officials, saying the urban Indigenous population is growing at an extremely rapid rate. MP Jamie Batiste of Sydney, Victoria was also present. He became the first Mi'kmaq to become a Member of Parliament and represent Nova Scotia in the House of Commons. The Native Friendship Centre will notably move to a new location, but will also develop new harm reduction projects, education and justice programs. More with reporter Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Today, on behalf of Indigenous Services Canada and ACOA, I'm pleased to announce nearly $5 million in federal funding to help the Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Centre design and construct a new facility and to provide new program delivery.
We're here today at the Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Center, where they announced they're receiving a $5 million investment from the Government of Canada for new facilities and program development. Speaking on behalf of government officials is the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry, and Member of Parliament of Halifax, Andy Fillmore. MP Fillmore's involvement in the project began in 2015.
Today's big turning point was this is the first big tranche of federal funding that's been made available to support the construction of the project. So it's a $4 million grant from Indigenous Services Canada to help pay for the design and some portion of the construction of a new Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Centre in downtown Halifax. Today's announcement was also $910,000 from ACOA to help to fund the more than 50 core programs the Friendship Center offers over the next 3 years while we bridge to whatever the next new center is going to be. So what the Friendship Center now has is $5 million, or rather $4 million for capital. They have the city on the cusp of granting them the land. And together, that becomes a very big lever to then go and pursue the additional funding that's required to actually build the project.
MP Fillmore discusses the different types of programs that we can expect on the new land, saying their main objective is to deliver the essential core projects.
The main job will be to continue to deliver the core programming that is required, whether that's around housing, whether it's around skills development, substance abuse counseling, daycare. There are more than 50 of them, so there are a lot of programs.
He said the urban Indigenous population in Halifax is growing at a fast rate.
The urban Indigenous population is growing at an extremely rapid rate. We're at more than 7,000 Indigenous people living in Halifax right now.
The second guest speaker was Jaime Batiste, Parliamentary Secretary to the Crown and Indigenous Relations. Batiste made history by being the first Mi'kmaq Member of Parliament in Canada of Sydney, Victoria. We ask MP Batiste how it feels to be the first Mi'kmaq to represent Nova Scotia in the House of Commons.
I was hesitant at first, but really very much believed it was time for a Mi'kmaq representative to be elected in the province of Nova Scotia, whether it provincially or federally. And I've really enjoyed now not only being elected, but re-elected in the Sydney-Victoria riding. And so it's always... It's always a challenge being the first, but it's, I appreciate it making history.
MP Batiste explains why this project is important to him.
You lose that sense of community when you come to an urban location, but I always knew that the Friendship Center had Indigenous people here and that this is where you could come and, there was a safe space. You knew that people shared your values, you could speak your language. It was somewhere that, you could still feel part of the Indigenous community away from your Indigenous community. And that's why it's so vital for us to make sure that we continue to support these programs.
Speaking after Batiste was Pamela Glode Desrochers, Executive Director of the Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Center, who has been with the Society for over 30 years.
I know you've moved to a new location. What else is new in comparison to the years before?
Oh my, we continue to grow. We continue to add programs, some harm reduction projects, some education programs that we're adding on, some justice, housing and homelessness, of course, has been a huge, huge piece for us. I've been with the Friendship Center for 30 plus years, ED for the last 14 years, I'd say now, and we went from 8 programs to 55.
Ending the conference, we listened to a heartfelt story of how a once homeless woman, now a joint triage support worker, Charlotte Bernard, received help by joining the Mi'kmaq Native Friendship Society. Bernard explains why the center is so important to people.
They asked me to speak on what the Friendship Center means to people. And 36 years ago, I was 18 years old. My father dropped me off in Bedford, gave me $20, and said, go live your life. I come from Indian Brook, Shubenacadie Reserve, and I didn't know anything about the city. I think I might have been in the city like 4 times in my entire life. But I did make it to the Friendship Center. And when I got to the Friendship Center, I'm gonna cry, because I met other people like me. Through the years, I have used this center in so many different ways. I was homeless, I lived in their shelter. I did upgrading, addictions. And when I came to the city, I was a broken little girl. When I had my babies, I was still a broken young woman. Through the years, I've got healing, I've grown friendships, I've met beautiful people. And 3 years ago, I shifted over to the Friendship Center. And here, I found my place. I've come full circle. I'm a triage support worker, so I do all the intakes for the Friendship Center. And as people come in, I know where they're coming from. This Friendship Center is a home away from home.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
The George Bryson Heritage House Museum reopened to the public on the morning of May 20th. A group of public officials, local citizens, and media gathered in Mansfield et Pontefract, Quebec, to celebrate the opening of the new museum. The museum is a Georgia-style house built in 1854, which was classified in the 1980s as an historical building. It was at one time deserted and started to deteriorate, but in 1970, a group of citizens acquired the building and surrounding dependencies and started working on its restoration. More than 30 years later, it became a museum. As reported by our colleague Caleb Nickerson, posted in Pontiac, Quebec, several local dignitaries were present for the official opening of the museum at the George Bryson Heritage House, Fort Coulonge Mayor Christine Francoeur, Louis Harvey of Far West, Pontiac Warden Jane Toller, MNA André Fortin and MP Sophie Châtel were present. Speaking about the museum, Mansfield Mayor Sandra Armstrong said that the house had seen a lot of changes over the years.
I mean, this house has known lots of things happening in the house, but it was restored a few years ago by Mrs. Ruth Erte, and she had a committee working on it, and there's lots of repairs to be done. So we did a few things through the years. And we've met, Mrs. Root was already working with Dominique Dufour, Museum Griff, and we were restoring one piece at a time. I think it's now that it should be open to public. We did lots of work, still artifacts to get, but we're getting there one day at a time, and it's a beautiful house. I think when I opened the door, it was already here, but you just pass and you don't wonder, it's here and it's built up. But when you come in, it's into another area here, and you just come in and you fall in love with it. So,
Dominique Dufour, a museum expert that worked on the new exhibits, said that they would be filling out the space in the future, and there would be a new exhibit swapping out every so often.
So I'm a member in the Bryson House since at least 3 years. We built a new exhibition among the COVID situation, so it was longer than previously planned. We cover 11 subjects about the Bryson House, the life in the Pontiac, and all the forestry aspect, and the lumbers, the driver, the raftman. And we have also a special room, a temporary exhibition about the beaver. And the last one is about the Red Bridge. So it's a brand new exhibition. If you come this summer, you may think it's a little empty because we will add more object and we will change the subject. So it's a work in progress, but at least the base is there and it will be improving and changing. So also it's a way to attract people to come and see it every year, to see the novelties and the new subject.
So that's it for us. Thanks to our journalists Caleb Nickerson, Ed Halverson, Sarah Gouda, David Gordon Kosh, and Alexander Wright, and to our national news coordinator, Maureen McEwen. You can tune in to all our stories produced each week by some 30 journalists working across Canada on canada-info.ca. That's canada-info.ca. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. This program is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for being with us. See you next week.